This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In Iran today, a judge revised the sentence for dissident academic Hashem Agajari to 3 years in prison after he declared that Muslims should not blindly follow clerical leaders like monkeys. Agajari had been sentenced to death for blasphemy. Iran's Supreme Court overturned that ruling after large student demonstrations and international protests. And Iran's foreign ministry today rejected recent reports of Iranian involvement in September the 11th as fabrication and fantasy. Some of the 9/11 hijackers may have crossed the country's border illegally, a spokesman said, but received no help from Iranian officials. Yesterday, President Bush said the U.S. is digging into the facts about Iranian involvement. The 9/11 Commission is expected to provide more on the alleged Iranian connection in its report due out tomorrow. Due out Thursday. U.S. relations with Iran have been frozen since the revolution and the hostage crisis 25 years ago. The U.S. government is deeply concerned about human rights, Iran's support for terrorism, and what looks to many like a nuclear weapons program. Despite all that, a new report from the Council on Foreign Relations says it's time for the U.S. to engage Iran in discussions, maybe even some deals. Is it time to reopen the dialogue with Tehran? What's to gain? What's to lose? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now by phone from his office here in Washington is Zbigniew Brzezinski, National Security Advisor 25 years ago during the Carter administration and co-chair of the Council on Foreign Relations Task Force that issued the report, Iran, Time for a New Approach. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Nice to be with you.
Your report begins with a simple conclusion that the government in Iran is not likely to be changed anytime soon.
That is correct. We don't see much evidence that would indicate that the government is in jeopardy, that it's likely to be overthrown. And we feel that given that, and given the general crisis in that region, and particularly given the U.S. involvement in that region, it would be in the U.S. national interest to see whether on some issues we can explore the possibility of a more normal relationship.
Some people would argue that after elections in which many of the legislators were not allowed to run because they were ruled out by the clerics, that the United States should have no particular reason to reopen relations with Iran right now.
Well, that would be a rather interesting way of conducting foreign policy. We didn't like the government in China, and yet in the 1970s, we were able to approach China, to establish a dialogue with China, to draw up some joint principles governing our relationship, and a few years later, that led to the normalization of relations. It was started by President Nixon and Dr. Kissinger. It was consummated by President Carter and myself. So there are lots of precedents for the U.S. dealing with governments whose internal conduct we do not like.
There is an active reform movement, though, in Iran. Some might regard the U.S. opening a dialogue with the Iranian government at this point as selling out the reformers.
I doubt it very much. I think, in fact, a dialogue with Iran on the official level does tend to create an atmosphere which furthers the opportunities for liberal movements within. That was, for example, our experience with the communist regimes in Eastern Europe and in the Soviet Union, that once we started having a dialogue, we were able to increase the room for maneuver for internal groups, thereby cumulatively contributing not only to a more stable relationship with the government, but to more internal change within these societies.
Others might say Iran has long been on the State Department's list of states supporting terrorism. Its support of Hezbollah in Lebanon and these most recent allegations involving links to al-Qaeda. It is holding several al-Qaeda members of al-Qaeda in Iran. The United States has not been happy that those people have not been released. Aren't you rewarding a state that sponsors terrorism?
Libya has also been on that list. And yet we have just started diplomatic relations with Libya. In brief, things change over time, and these allegations regarding Iran pertain to the past. What is going on right now may be different. In any case, it can be explored. When it comes to the specific issue of some al-Qaeda people in Iran, the fact is that there are people in Iraq, which is now controlled by the U.S., that have been engaged in terrorist activities in Iran. And we have put that group in Iraq, which is acting against the Iranian government, on the terrorist list. So we are in the embarrassing position, in effect, of providing a kind of a shelter, a military umbrella, for a group in Iraq that we have labeled as terrorist and which is engaged in activities against Iran.
You speak of the Mujahideen al-Khalq.
Exactly.
Yes. You mentioned Libya, though. The United States reestablished relations with Libya after Libya renounced its programs for weapons of mass destruction, specifically nuclear weapons programs. Iran, your report suggests, is heading the other way.
Do you think the Libyans did that just out of the blue as a big surprise, as a gift to us? Or was it preceded by months and months of very painful dialogue, but also patient dialogue with the Libyans? That's precisely what we're talking about.
So where would you begin?
We would begin by talking to the Iranians on a variety of issues in which we both may have an interest, such as, what about stability in Iraq? What about stability in Afghanistan? What about nuclear programs that the Iranians are pursuing? What about economic relationships and foreign investment? What about terrorist activities, either assisted by the Iranians or even sponsored by the Iranians? And, of course, the Iranians will raise the question of terrorist activities directed against them that they view as indirectly sponsored by us. There's a large agenda. The point is, the way to begin, perhaps, would be even to sit down and simply draw up a list of issues to be discussed without any excessive expectation that there's going to be a grand settlement all at once. But without talking, what is the policy then? Just simply isolating them, sitting on the sidelines, and perhaps encouraging them to make life more miserable for us in Afghanistan and Iraq?
Yet, you say there's no room for a grand bargain. Why not?
Because these issues are complicated. And the Chinese case is a very good example. If someone had started in 72 saying to China, let's have a grand bargain right away, they probably would have gotten bogged down. I think the way Nixon and Kissinger went about it was very sensible. Let's draw up a list of issues. Let's have a statement of principles guiding our relationship, and then go on from there. And we did go on from there, and then we negotiated when we were in office with the Chinese for a year and a half, almost 2 years, before we reached some accommodation and normalization followed. Unless we do this, we really are encouraging the Iranians to make life more miserable for us in a huge region in which we're not only engaged, but in which we're increasingly running the risk of being overstretched.
We're discussing a proposal to renew engagement, diplomatic engagement with Iran. Our guest is Zbigniew Brzezinski, the former National Security Advisor. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Let's take a call from Matthew, who joins us from Salisbury, Maryland.
Yes. Good afternoon to both of you.
Good afternoon.
I totally agree with your expert and also have a question. I remember in the mid-90s, it seemed as though the Iranians were making subtle but relatively aggressive, in some ways, peace overtures towards the United States. I remember the president of Iran presenting kind of a message to the American people, trying to show the similarities that we had with them. And then also, if I remember correctly, there were two wrestling teams, one from the United States and one from Iran, that had some kind of a match in either country, and it seemed like relations were getting better. And I just wanted to know, what happened?
What happened essentially, and that's an important point, what happened essentially was that the hardliners in Iran put a stop to it. And we have no guarantee that efforts to undertake the kind of dialogue that our task force has proposed will succeed. But we feel that it's in our national interest that we move in that direction if we can. And if the Iranians abort that, then so be it. In the end, I think they will suffer more than we will, but we'll both suffer. So I think it's a smart thing to try, and there's no downside, basically, to trying.
There have been several episodes where the idea that there were Iranian moderates has turned out not to be correct.
Yeah, but we're not planning to talk just to the moderates. We're preparing, we're willing, according to this task force report, to talk to the government power, because they're in power. In the Chinese case, we talked to Mao Zedong, not exactly a hero in my lexicon, or yours. In fact, a very bloodthirsty tyrant. But we did talk to him, and then it led to something quite significant.
What did you mean they might suffer more if they abort the process than we would?
We are so much richer and more powerful. We are really very much part of the world. They're somewhat isolated. They have economic problems. They also have security problems. We seem to think that only our security matters. But the Iranians live in a very dangerous part of the world. Four of their immediate neighbors, or practically immediate neighbors, proximate neighbors, have nuclear weapons. They have some anxieties, too. And I think, frankly, if they were to talk to us, and if there was a serious dialogue that eventually became constructive, they would be better off for it.
Matthew, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's go now to Devar. Devar is on the line with us from Reseda, California. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yeah, that's correct. My name is Devar.
Okay, go ahead.
And thanks for taking my call, Your Majesty. And my question is, Mr. Brzezinski, 25 years ago, came out with the idea of Green Belt to prevent communism going any farther toward Iran and Persian Gulf. And we ended up having a 25 years of totalitarian regime, as a brutal regime that is even not only massacring his own people, he's massacring, you know, the other people around the world with their fundamentalism. My question is, how can we prevent another mistake that Mr. Brzezinski is going to make by suggesting talking to Iran and not waiting another 25 years to have another September 11 or maybe an atomic, you know, the war? And
Why do we get a response to that? And I'm not sure.
I'm not quite sure what the policy implication of that observation is, because it's really a rhetorical question. Are we supposed to simply wait and to hope things work out on their own? After all, there are things developing which could be ominous, including the nuclear program. Unless the caller has the idea that we should invade Iran the way that we invaded Iraq, I don't think there's much of an alternative. Now, if we're going to invade Iran, I hope people like the caller will be in the first ranks of those who go there to fight, because right now we're militarily so stretched that I'm not even sure that it would be very smart activity undertaking for us to pursue purely from a military point of view, not to mention what it would do to the American position in the world if we were to invade yet another country. So I think in these circumstances, what we are proposing is not only sensible, but very much in our national interest.
And you're not talking about reestablishing diplomatic relations. You're talking about dialogue.
We're talking about a dialogue on a number of contentious issues in which there are different points of view, but involve the interests of the two parties respectively, and which perhaps over time might gradually be resolved. And the precedents I have in mind are the Chinese example, the Libyan example, and now the ongoing six-power talks with North Korea. If in every instance the solution is to be purely a military attack, we're going to compound the problem that we already have in Iraq. And if the other solution is to do nothing, then, of course, drift will create its own outcomes. And in the case of Iran, probably will end up with a hostile but nuclear-armed Iran.
More with Zbigniew Brzezinski after a short break. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the possibility of U.S. diplomatic overtures toward Iran. Our guest is former National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski, co-chair of the Council on Foreign Relations Task Force that just published the report, Iran Time, for a new approach. If you have questions about how the U.S. might change its policy in Iran or towards Iran, give us a call, 800-989-8255, or you can send us email, the address totn@npr.org. And Mr. Brzezinski, the other day, President Bush said that it would be intolerable if Iran were to develop nuclear weapons. You talked about a strong imperative for Iran to develop nuclear weapons. Its neighbors, Russia, India, Pakistan, and Israel are all nuclear powers or nuclear-armed powers. How can we possibly dissuade Iran from going ahead with this?
It's certainly not going to be easy, but if we pursue the kind of an approach that we favor, we're more likely to have the support of other countries, the Europeans, the Japanese, with whom the Iranians would like to develop closer economic and financial ties because they need their foreign investment, they need their trade. So we would be in a better position to offer some incentives as well as disincentives for their pursuit of nuclear weapons. I don't think we can persuade them alone. And notice that with North Korea, we're pursuing a multilateral approach in the hope of that being more effective, providing that combination of incentives and disincentives. Simply a military resolution at this stage would gravely compound the overall situation in that region, because it would give then every incentive to the Iranians to really destabilize Afghanistan and Iraq, something which they could easily do given their situation, their geographic position.
Would you agree, though, that it would be intolerable for Iran to develop nuclear weapons?
Well, you know, we said the same thing about Pakistan earlier. We have said the same thing about North Korea. We even said that about the Berlin Wall. There are many things in life that are intolerable, and yet you have to live with them because the alternative is worse. And unless one comes up with a good solution, a workable solution, and not one driven also by false information, one has to be very careful.
Let's get another.
At present moment, we don't have any indication that the acquisition of nuclear weapons by Iran is imminent. That's also an important fact to consider.
Let's get another caller on the line. Sheila is with us from Fairfax, Virginia.
Hello. Thank you for having me on the air. Mm-hmm. And I'm a great fan of Dr. Brzezinski. I had a question for him. Given the dualistic nature of the Iranian government currently, how would you go about, with whom would you talk regarding the possible carrots and sticks method of pursuing foreign policy with them and getting these benefits out with the extremists and the moderates? It's a little bit difficult to differentiate who really has power, and I take my comments off the air.
Thanks for the call, Sheila.
Well, Sheila, first of all, thank you for your kind comments. I also live in Fairfax County, so it's nice to have a friendly neighbor. One would talk to the government. There is a government that's in power. It is a government which, by and large, tends to be theocratic and fundamentalist. So these are not people we agree with on values or even on policy issues, but they are in power. They're like the Chinese government under Mao Zedong, with whom we talked. They're like the Libyan government of Gaddafi, with whom we talked. They're like the North Korean government, with whom we're talking. In all three cases, they're like them in the sense that they are in power. I'm not trying to say that they have similar views to the Chinese or the Libyans or the North Koreans. So you obviously talk to the government. And if that government is willing to talk and is prepared to explore those issues, then we can determine whether there is a mutual interest in some movement on these issues. And we can never establish that unless we talk to them.
Earlier today at a news conference in Bahrain, General Abizaid, the U.S. Military commander, the CENTCOM commander, that part of the world, said that some elements from Iran appeared to be involved in less than positive activities in Iraq. He did not say it was Iranian government policy. But in what way can Iran help us or hurt us in Iraq?
Well, presumably it can become more involved in encouraging Shiite opposition to us, and it may be doing that already, though bear in mind that we also have people in Iraq who are doing the same thing in Iran, in effect under our protection. So there are possibilities for activities, disruptive activities, on both sides.
Yesterday, after the allegations surfaced of possible Iranian ties to 9/11, the State Department spokesman Richard Boucher said the United States would be willing to sit down and talk with the Iranians if the president determines it's in our interest. This, of course, the same president who put Iran in the axis of evil. What's your take on what the administration will do at this point?
Well, I think the common sense conclusion is that we have to talk because we don't have better alternatives. Isolation doesn't work because the rest of the world doesn't want to follow our lead. And after the experience with Iraq, there's much less inclination to support us on such issues. But if we are prepared to explore some of the issues that I have mentioned, I think we would have more international support and therefore even more leverage in dealing with the Iranians. On this Al-Qaeda business, which people keep bringing up, let's also use common sense. Look, what is alleged is that these operatives passed through Iran, and later on, some of them participated in 9/11. But just think about what that means. So they passed through Iran. Did they go from Iran directly to the United States and commit 9/11? Or did they go through other countries? And I don't want to mention even what countries, but anyone can look at the map, and they can guess themselves what those countries might be if these people got here from Afghanistan via Iran. There had to be quite a few other countries they traversed. Are we going to allege next that those other countries were somehow complicit with Al-Qaeda? You know, and if we don't, then on what basis can we really firmly conclude that the Iranians were complicit?
Well, I think the allegation is that the Iranian immigration officials did not put an Iranian stamp in any of those Saudi Arabian passports.
Yeah, but the others were passed through by other countries.
Well, I know you have another appointment and you have to leave us. We appreciate your time today.
Very good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you.
Bye-bye.
Zbigniew Brzezinski, co-chair of the Independent Task Force Iran, Time for a New Approach. That was published yesterday by the Council on Foreign Relations, and we spoke to him from his office here in Washington, D.C. Who's listening since the beginning and joining us now for a look at how these ideas might sound from inside Iran is Bahman Bakhtiari. He's director of the International Affairs Program at the University of Maine and recently returned from a trip to Iran. He joins us on the phone from his office in Orono, Maine. Good to speak with you again.
Well, thank you very much.
We just heard Zbigniew Brzezinski talk about the need for the United States to reopen talks with Iran and what might be in it for the United States. What's in it for Iran? Are they likely to listen?
Well, I've read the report issued by Brzezinski, and I think Dr. Brzezinski is correct on several points. One, the fact that the Iranian political system is here to stay for a long time and it does not face any internal threat. And second, not talking to the government or the people in power in Iran is really not beneficial for both sides. But I think the report is about 6-7 years late. And if this report was issued in 1997 or 1998 after President Khatami had been elected, he would have had by far more impact inside Iran. And I think developments in Iran have reached such a level of centralization of power by conservatives, and they're so removed from the people today, witnessing what they did with the parliamentary elections today, that I don't think they are secure enough to engage in any dialogue with the United States. So I cannot imagine what they will gain from talking to U.S. that they are not gaining already through talking from other intermediaries and other activities that they have.
You were, as we mentioned earlier, in Iran earlier this summer, or I guess late this spring. What is the political attitude towards the United States amongst the government officials there, this obviously in the aftermath of the invasion and occupation of Iraq?
I think the invasion of Iraq has impacted the public opinion in Iran, and the young, who constitute a majority of the population and probably a very potential force of change inside Iran and very, very anti-clerical, we could say, have begun to really doubt whether the change of regime in Iran brought about by United States could lead to the democratic aspirations that they have. So I think the pictures from Iraq and the Iranian government has done a very, very good job in exploiting those pictures from Abu Ghraib, the prison scandals and so forth, have created a situation that even if U.S. wants to engage in Iran, the conservatives will pursue their own interest that does not benefit the Iranian people or Iranian state or country. And Americans, if they're engaging Iran in a talk, they're interested in the problems they have in Iraq and Afghanistan, but not in resolving the long-term issues. So I think Dr. Brzezinski's observation is correct, but perceptions in Iran is that the U.S. will engage in a tactical short-term talks. And here it is all because of Iraq and Afghanistan, which the report mentioned several times. So I think it would not have the same impact as it believed to have.
Let's get another caller on the line. Andy's with us from Tallahassee, Florida.
Neil, thank you very much. A point that your current guest and Dr. Brzezinski have both referred to is are not the options that the U.S. has in the region greatly limited or constrained because of the invasion of Iraq, which I would argue is poorly justified and rather crude. It's now to the point where in the region there's great suspicion of the U.S. The U.S. has troops in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Turkmenistan, and now 130-some thousand next door in Iraq. Is that a reality that greatly constrains the options that the U.S. has in reaching out to whomever in Iran?
Am I responding to this, Neil?
I hope so.
Yes. Well, yes, of course it does, because the Iranian government has been very intelligent and clever in recognizing the needs of the United States in the region. So when it came to the war in Afghanistan, Iran played a major role in getting rid of the Taliban and helping the U.S. Northern Alliance, was a major pro-Iranian group that they had harbored. And when it came to Iraq, the Supreme Council of the Islamic Revolution was based in Tehran. And today, many members of the Iraqi interim government are from this group. So Iranians have done enough to make sure that the U.S. acknowledges their interests and their presence, but not so far as going to engaging in any direct talks that will call on them to do more. So from their perspective, I don't see what more can the U.S. do for them already that it's not doing right now in the region.
Andy, thank you.
Thank you, Neil.
You raised an interesting point before. The report by Dr. Brzezinski and others suggests small steps. What you said Iran would reject as tactical moves. Would a grand approach be more productive, do you think?
I think it's gone beyond the grand or small approach. It has become such a substantive issue that from the Iranian government point of view, the people in power today have extremely suspicious view of the United States. The Supreme Leader Khamenei is known to repeatedly reject anyone who comes up with any reason to say, let's have dialogue with U.S., and he's now extremely suspicious of it. So it takes a lot of confidence-building measures. I mean, I think Dr. Brzezinski knows, as an important person in the National Security Council, that when Iranian Revolution occurred in 1979, United States was caught off hand. They didn't know why that happened. And I think it will be difficult for U.S. to carry talks when they don't have good intelligence. They don't know such basic things in Iran. And how could those talks be beneficial when our intelligence is so poor about Iran and about the leadership in Iran?
It's certainly questionable in any case. We're talking about a proposal to reopen dialogue with Iran. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And here's an email we have from Ali in Minneapolis. I am an Iranian-American who fled Iran in 1979 as a result of the revolution. The majority of Iranian expats blame President Carter and Mr. Brzezinski's policies as a cause of the Iranian revolution. Iran's only hope is for President Bush helping to liberate these 70-plus million Iranians to have a government separated from the church.
Now, this caller obviously represents a viewpoint that is held strongly, and the expatriate community was so shocked, as I mentioned, by the revolution that took place, and obviously Jimmy Carter's administration was the administration that paid the price for all the previous administrations who had carried on with the Shah's regime, Kissinger, Lyndon Johnson previously, and so forth. And here there is this perception among the expatriates who left Iran that if without Jimmy Carter, there would not have been a revolution, but the social changes in Iran really contravene this argument that there are significant sources for revolution rather than American policy.
Let's get another call. Khodadad, I hope I'm not mangling that too badly, joins us on the line from San Diego.
Yeah, my name is Khodadad. I'm also an Iranian-American who came to this country. I did not flee or anything. I came here when I was 13. But my point is this. The people of Iran will be our best allies in the Middle East if we connect with them, because they have experienced democracy, but they've never really tasted it. And they love the ideology of democracy so much that we need to connect with them. And I agree with Dr. Brzezinski. Unfortunately, to do that, we'll have to go through the government in power at this time. But ultimate goal would be to connect with the people, and that will create the best allies this country would ever see in the Middle East.
Yes, I think that's true. The caller has picked on the point that the Iranian public, more than anything, I think, is tired of this continuous ideological rancoring between U.S. and Iran, and it's interesting to note that every time any Iranian leader gets up to attack the United States, many Iranians switch channels and deride him by saying, well, okay, it's the same speech. So they're tired, they're frustrated about it, and Iran has a young population, is very, very educated, 80% plus are educated, and anything, any dialogue has to somehow include the issue of democracy inside Iran. I cannot see any dialogue to be successful if it does not encourage what the caller accurately said, democracy inside Iran.
Should we begin with small steps, do you think, or how would you start? Do you honestly see this happening?
I think we ought to begin with small steps that were proposed by Khatami a long time ago, cultural steps. I think Fulbright scholarship, exchanges, sport exchanges, those are the things that Dr. Brzezinski mentioned just briefly, but they continued for a long time with Soviet Union and the communist countries before the actual dialogue got very serious. There were all these low-level civil society contacts. And I think the issue of the visa is very important. The visa policy of the United States has seriously cut the traveling of academics from Iran and even sportsmen from Iran. So these issues, if they are solved, I think it will create that two-pronged strategy of moving toward talks.
Khodadad, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
And we'd like to thank Bahman Bakhtiari for his time.
Thank you very much, Neil.
Bahman Bakhtiari, professor of international relations at the University of Maine, and we reached him at his office in Orono, Maine. We'll be talking about what happened to another former national security advisor, Sandy Berger, when we come back from a short break and get an idea of how secret are the secrets at the National Archives. We'll also have an update on the Tour de France, where Lance Armstrong has taken the lead. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.